And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. And before we get started, I'd like to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy so you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, URLs, web pages, email addresses, whatever it takes to take action and get the job done. I'm Uncle Dennis for Free Radio Santa Cruz, and let's get started. This is Thursday, October 29th. Everglades Earth First announces a week of resistance, November 27th through December 5th, in this story from Everglades Earth First, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Everglades Earth First is excited to host a week of resistance starting Friday, February 27th, ending with a mass demonstration organized by the Palm Beach County Environmental Coalition on Saturday, December 5th. Join us as we continue the Scrap Scripps, Save the Bridger Forest campaign. Resist corporations in the Everglades bioregion that destroy wild spaces to build upscale housing and biotechnology, including animal testing laboratories. During this week of action, we will focus on cross-movement building across South Florida, in addition to working on our forest defense campaign. As of now, we have dates set with the South Florida Smash HLS, an animal liberation group based out of Miami that is fighting monkey torturing company Worldwide Primates, and Fort Lauderdale Food Not Bombs, who share vegan and vegetarian food publicly to protest war and poverty. Details such as accommodations and schedule will be made available to those who register and are accepted to participate in the week with us. We will be accepting applications from now until November 26th. Please register at www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net. That's www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net. And Hambach forest campaigners in Germany sabotage mining equipment in this story from the Chaos Engineering crew, Hambach Forest, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Last night, which was Monday, we sabotaged 8 construction machines in the area which is to be prepared for the open cast mining. At 5 excavators, 2 bulldozers, a road roller, and another expensive-looking thing, all hydraulic hoses and electrical cables that could be reached were cut. The tanks and oil filters were filled with sand, all the windows smashed, and other mechanical components sabotaged. Despite all the security measures taken by RWE, this action was carried out with no problems. This action is directed against the open cast mining operator RWE and its collaborators who destroy the livelihoods of the planet just for profit. While the vast majority of people in Germany sit silently in front of their TV screens, distracted from the daily destruction by smart entertainers and prophets of permanent growth, die in other parts of the world already hundreds of thousands of effects of climate change, partly caused by RWE. While most people should be aware that it cannot go on this way, it unfortunately is until now only a small minority who are willing to take action against the destruction and who thereby are putting their own health and freedom at risk. Actually, 3 of these people are sitting in prisons in Cologne and Aachen for their attempts to prevent the destruction of the Hambach Forest by RWE. In the course of their captures, all 3 were abused either by the police or by security service of RWE. One person's nose was broken and several teeth were knocked out. We therefore wish to show solidarity by means of our action, especially with the actual detainees, and make it clear that we will not be intimidated in any way, because it's about all. Hoping to motivate other people to such actions, the Chaos Engineering crew. And documents in British Columbia wolf cull have been linked to forestry industry concerns in this story by Mike Hume of the Globe and Mail, as found on the Earth First Newswire. British Columbia's government has been meeting with the forest industry to develop plans to save endangered caribou, and the province appears to have launched its controversial wolf cull program to avoid putting further restrictions on logging. The wolf kill, which started last January, has drawn international condemnation from environmentalists, while the British Columbia government has defended it as necessary to save dwindling caribou populations. Mountain caribou, which need old-growth forest to survive, are listed under the Federal Species at Risk Act, and the province is required to take action to save them. But briefing notes prepared for meetings between British Columbia government Environment Minister Mary Polack and the industry representatives in 2014 suggest the government was prompted by the forest industry to launch the wolf cull because of fears a federal recovery plan for caribou would demand that more logging areas be set aside. Tolco Industries Limited is concerned about potential impacts of the federal recovery strategy for woodland caribou, states one of the notes, released in response to a Freedom of Information application. Ottawa's recovery strategy states that caribou need large tracts of undisturbed habitat rich in mature old-growth conifer forest. It is up to the province to decide how much forest land to set aside. Environmentalists have long complained that British Columbia has not made enough old-growth forest off-limits to logging. At the time of Ms. Polack's meetings, the British Columbia government's Mountain Caribou Recovery Implementation Program, and known as the MCRIP, had already set aside some forest land, established a captive breeding program for caribou, and limited recreational snowmobile access in caribou areas. But a proposed wolf cull had not yet been launched. Actions within the MCRIP have largely been implemented with the exception of effectively managing wolf populations. Industry has criticized government for failing to effectively implement this recovery action, and it will be very reluctant to forego additional harvesting opportunities to meet any additional habitat targets imposed by the federal recovery strategy, states the briefing note from April 2014. British Columbia's wolf cull began several months later. The briefing notes also show that the forest industry and government were interested in aligning strategies with respect to dealing with the federal government on caribou issue. One entry states that the province's caribou plan had been tested with numerous high-level stakeholders, including the Council on Forest Industries, which represents forestry companies in British Columbia, before it was posted for public comment. Wilderness Committee Director Gwen Barley, who filed the Freedom of Information application that pried the documents loose, said she is alarmed by how closely the government and forestry industry appear to have been working. Are we having the British Columbia government write recovery strategies for species at risk, or are we having logging companies writing recovery strategies for species at risk? She asked. A recovery strategy is supposed to be a document created by science, Ms. Barley stated. Obviously, the recovery strategies are becoming polluted with the economic interests of logging companies, and that is not supposed to be the case. Sean Nixon, and a lawyer for EcoJustice, also found the government briefing notes disturbing. This looks like the forest industry in British Columbia is either directing the government's policy on species at risk, where that might affect timber harvesting, or at a minimum, the provincial government is running the policy by the forest industry to make sure it's okay with them. Either is troubling, he added. If a provincial government does not effectively protect an endangered species listed under SARA, Ottawa can impose regulations on provincial land. Given British Columbia's approach so far, which seems more concerned about logging interests than the needs of the caribou, the federal government may have to do just that. And Arctic warming produces mosquito swarms large enough to kill baby caribou, in this story by Cole Molino of EcoWatch, as found on the Earth First Newswire. This article was reposted and is rebroadcast with permission from EcoWatch. Some Alaskans joke that mosquitoes are Alaska's state bird, but the pesky insects are becoming no joke. Warming Arctic temperatures have caused their numbers to swell immensely in the region in recent years. Lauren Culler has been studying insects in Greenland for the past several years. Culler, a postdoctoral researcher at Dartmouth College Institute for Arctic Studies, along with a team of researchers, published a study recently in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, number B. Their findings are not good for humans, caribou, or other mammals that call the Arctic home. The study answers why this is happening. When the Arctic warming twice as fast as the rest of the planet, the Arctic's waterways, or mosquito breeding grounds, are melting up to several weeks sooner. Thus, mosquitoes are hatching earlier and earlier. It was really when the pond thawed that triggered the hatch, Culler told National Geographic. That's not unexpected. Lots of biology is triggered by these melting events, but that's not what Culler found. The warmer environment also allowed mosquitoes to reach maturity faster, thus allowing more and more to survive to adulthood. Mosquitoes are most vulnerable and most likely to be picked off by predators in their early stages of life, as most animals are. The faster they go through these life stages, the better off they are, Culler said. If you're only exposed for 20 days instead of 24, that's good for you. That's 4 days you don't have to worry about being eaten. Caribou, mosquitoes' main food source, and other Arctic animals might be able to cope with these swarms if they weren't already threatened by a changing climate. Ross Anderson at The Atlantic said the climate changes wreaked havoc on the natural cycles of the Arctic environment. Plants which the caribou rely on as a food source are emerging earlier and earlier because of the warmer temperatures, but caribou are still calving based on the cycle of the sun. By the time caribou calves are born in May or June, there is not enough food to go around. Mothers are becoming malnourished, fewer calves are being born, and fewer are surviving their crucial first few months, said Anderson. And even if they do survive, they are still vulnerable to overhunting and the diseases carried north by deer that would never have survived the Arctic chill of yesteryear. Now add the growing swarms of mosquitoes, and you see why it's a real problem. Arctic mosquito swarms are the stuff of legend, says Anderson. Some of them contain hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of insects. That's enough to harass a pregnant caribou until she stops worrying about food, and it's enough to kill caribou calves outright. They inundate entire herds, and the caribou's only defense is to flee, leading to decreased eating and further stress on the population. Research from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has found that insect harassment interferes with caribou foraging, which also decreases survival. In high enough numbers, they can drain enough blood to fell a caribou and sometimes even kill it, says the video. The caribou are forced off their grazing grounds by a predator 10 million times smaller than they are. That's got to sting. And it's only expected to get worse. Culler took some of the mosquitoes into her lab and placed them directly into slightly warm water to simulate Arctic waters of the near future. Her results? The mosquitoes hatched even earlier and grew even faster. Mother caribou are becoming malnourished. Fewer calves are being born and fewer are surviving their crucial first few months, says Anderson. And even when they do survive, they are still vulnerable to overhunting. With Arctic sea ice hitting its fourth lowest level on record, the Arctic can expect more and more swarms of mosquitoes in the future. Humans in the Arctic are feeling the pinch as well. Culler told National Geographic that a colleague in Greenland was assaulted by more than 100 mosquitoes at once, and the bugs in that region were mild for the Arctic. You can be completely covered in a matter of seconds, Culler added. And a report card wraps Australian efforts to improve reef water quality in this story by Sonali Paul, editing by Paul Tate, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Australia's attempts to curb damage to the Great Barrier Reef, which was almost listed as being in danger earlier this year, are falling well short of targets, a report released by the National and Queensland state governments said recently. The progress report showed water quality in areas close to shore along the world's largest coral reef remained poor due to nitrogen, pesticide, and sediment runoff from farms as well as from cyclones and floods. If one of my kids came home with a report card like this, I'd be a bit disappointed. There's more bad news in here than good, Queensland Environment Minister Stephen Mills told reporters at the River Symposium in the Queensland state capital of Brisbane. Improving water quality was one of the main goals in the Australian government's Reef 2050 long-term sustainability plan, which was central to persuading UNESCO's World Heritage Committee not to blacklist the reef as endangered last July. Miles said the rate of progress between 2013 and 14 towards state and federal government's water quality improvement targets had slowed dramatically. However, there had been some recovery of coral and seagrass in one catchment area where discharges had dropped. Australia has targeted farmers to try and change the way they use fertilizer and pesticides to curb runoff into coastal waters and limit damage to coral and seagrasses. Being in the tropics with cyclones and the rest adds complexity, but we still need to do more, said Roger Shaw, chairman of the Great Barrier Reef Science Panel, who put the report card together. The grains industry was the only one achieving close to best practice targets so far, while graziers were making good progress. The sugar cane industry was the big laggard, according to the report. It's disappointing, Shaw told Reuters. He said part of the problem with sugarcane was that the fertilizer is applied all at once. It can then be leached off if there is a cyclone or flood during the growing season. Trials are being run to improve fertilizer coatings to help tackle the problem. And moving to news about Sea Shepherd. Sea Shepherd has concluded its grueling Faroe Islands pilot whale defense campaign. The Dutch-registered Sea Shepherd ships San Simon and Bob Barker have arrived in the port of Bremen, Germany, marking the official conclusion of Sea Shepherd's sixth Faroe Islands pilot whale defense campaign, Operation Sleipnir Grendene. The returning crews received a hero's welcome as supporters gathered to greet them following the grueling 3.5-month-long campaign. The ships joined Sea Shepherd's Australian-registered fast trimmer in the Bridget Bardot, which returned to Bremen from the Faroe Islands in late September. Sea Shepherd's land crew of international volunteers, who have been on the ground in the Faroe Islands since June 16th, also departed from the archipelago last week. While 490 pilot whales have been slaughtered in the Faroe Islands since June this year alone, the lives of hundreds more have been saved over the course of Operation Sleipnir Grendene, thanks to Sea Shepherd's direct action. Pods of pilot whales, white-sided dolphins, white-beaked dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, and Risso's dolphins are among those that have been led away from the killing beaches of the archipelago and led safely back out to sea by Sea Shepherd ships. Chief Engineering Officer of Sea Shepherd Global, Captain Alex Cornelissen, stated, "I would like to extend a huge congratulations to all Sea Shepherd crews, both land and sea, who stood up to defend the pilot whales of the Faroe Islands on Operation Sleipnir Grendene. Few know the tireless dedication that is required to make these campaigns happen. It has been an incredibly demanding 3.5 months, but we have achieved great successes for the pilot whales and for the oceans. The triumphs of Operation Sleipnir Grendene have been achieved in the face of great adversity. A total of 14 Sea Shepherd volunteers representing 11 countries were arrested throughout the campaign. 10 of those volunteers were subsequently deported for the crime of defending pilot whales. On August 24th, the international crew of the Bob Barker was denied entry into the Faroe Islands by Danish authorities in an action that Sea Shepherd's legal counsel has described as unlawful. Faroese and Danish authorities have confiscated a total of 4 Sea Shepherd small boats, 3 of those during the course of Operation Sleipnir Grendene. The Farley small boat, which was detained on July 20th, remains in police custody over 1 month after charges relating to the boat's confiscation were dropped. The Echo small boat was confiscated in the Shetland Islands, Scotland, on September 1st, and later extradited to the Faroe Islands by the Danish Navy ship HDMS Knud Rasmussen, despite the fact that a warrant to block the extradition had been issued by the High Court of Judiciary in Scotland. However, Sea Shepherd has risen above these challenges, and in doing so has garnered unprecedented levels of international attention for the plight of pilot whales and other dolphins in the Faroe Islands. As well, Sea Shepherd has ensured that the government of Denmark is being held to account for its continued complicity in the atrocities of the Grindehvalen. On July 23rd, over 250 pilot whales were slaughtered in the archipelago with the assistance of the Danish Navy and police and the backing of the Danish government. International outcry followed as media outlets around the world relayed graphic video and photographic evidence of the horrors captured by Sea Shepherd crews on the ground. Demonstrations were held in Australia, Belgium, Canada, Chile, Italy, Luxembourg, Germany, France, Spain, and the United States as people took to the streets to stand up against the Grindehvalen. In early August, 2 major German cruise liner companies, AIDA and Hapag-Lloyd, announced they had canceled tours to the Faroe Islands in response to the ongoing pilot whale slaughter. On August 19th, the Scottish town of Wick severed its 20-year-long twin-town relationship with the Faroese city of Klaksvík, and said it would not look to reinstate official relationships until the disgusting slaughter of whales in the archipelago is banned. Political representatives from the United Kingdom, Italy, and Luxembourg have all publicly announced their disdain for the ongoing practice of the Grindehvalen, which the Danish government actively supports in defiance of sentiments of the European Union obligations and international legal responsibilities. Sea Shepherd Land Team Leader Rosie Kunuk stated, "We mourn for all those pilot whales and other dolphins that lost their lives to the brutality of the Grunda drop. However, thanks to the efforts of Sea Shepherd, these beautiful creatures have not died in vain. What's more, hundreds of other pilot whales and dolphins are still alive today because of Sea Shepherd crews, and this is something we are immensely proud of. Even though Operation Slipid Gundini has officially concluded for 2015, Sea Shepherd has vowed to continue its fight against the Grunda drop from afar. Whether it be pressure on the ground, at sea, in the media, in the courts, or in the hearts and minds of people from around the world, Sea Shepherd will continue to stand up against the horrors of the Grunda drop for all the pilot whales who are still swimming free and need our protection," said Captain Cornelison. Sea Shepherd has been leading opposition to the mass slaughter of pilot whales and other dolphins in the Faroese Islands since the 1980s. Operation Slipid Gundini has been one of the organization's most successful campaigns in the archipelago, led by its strong at-sea presences in the region to date. And for further information about Sea Shepherd, please go to www.seashepherd.org.au. www.seashepherd.org.au. And a Florida bear call has been called off after hunters kill nearly 300 bears. In this story by Curtis Skinner, with additional reporting by Letitia Stein and Barbara Liston, editing by Nick McPhee, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Florida's first bear hunt in two decades, which sparked protests by animal rights activists, was called off after just 2 days, after nearly 300 bears were killed, wildlife officials said on Sunday. The hunt, which was slated to last up to 1 week and would allow as many as 320 black bears to be killed, was ended after 295 of the animals were, quote, harvested, unquote, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission said in a statement. The hunt aimed to stabilize a population of bears that have rebounded to more than 3,000 from several hundred in the 1970s, according to the commission. The agency said hunting in the central and east panhandle regions of the state was closed on Saturday after just 1 day of hunting, as hunters were more proficient than anticipated. Regulated hunting has a long successful history of contributing to wildlife conservation in North America. Of the 41 states with resident bear populations, 33 of them conduct hunts and all have stable to increasing bear populations, the commission's statement said. Hunt opponents held statewide protests on Friday, aiming to build on the international outrage generated this summer by the killing of Cecil, a rare black-maned lion, by an American dentist who was on an African hunting trip. A few dozen held a vigil on Sunday for the bears at a wildlife management area at Rock Springs Run in Sorrento, according to the Orlando Sentinel newspaper. "The real raw fact of the matter of losing these bears is devastating to many of us in the community," Emily Ruff of Florida School of Holistic Living told the newspaper. State wildlife officers have received increasing complaints about bears in neighborhoods close to woodlands, where the animals have long roamed as suburban development has further encroached on their habitat. Open garbage cans and unattended backyard grills attract bears looking for an easy meal. Hunt opponents say programs to eliminate such food sources could reduce conflicts between bears and humans more effectively than hunting. At least 4 Floridians were injured in bear attacks in the past 2 years, mostly in the suburbs north of Orlando, Florida. The hunt came at a time when several western states are considering regulations that would make it easier to hunt cougars. Through the scope of the expansion varies widely, according to the Humane Society. And revoke the Army Corps license to kill cormorants. More than 10,000 of the Pacific Northwest's gorgeous double-crested cormorants could be wrongfully killed if you don't act fast. The Fish and Wildlife Service has authorized the U.S. Army Corps to conduct a mass killing on East Sand Island near the mouth of the Columbia River, but the reasoning behind the move is deeply flawed. The federal agencies are scapegoating the native birds for recent declines in imperiled salmon and steelhead, but the real culprit is mismanagement of the area's dams, which disrupt the fish runs. A recently released document from the service's own biologists reemphasizes that cormorants aren't to blame. Biologists found that salmon and steelhead eaten by cormorants would have died anyway, consumed by other predators. The Act now to urge the service to immediately revoke the Army Corps permit. It's not too late to address the real problem and save those birds. And 90% of seabirds have plastic in their stomachs. A new study by a team of Australia's Federal Science Agency brings sad news about seabirds. About 90% already have plastic garbage in their bodies, and according to computer models, by 2050, that percentage will hover around 99%. Older studies have shown that only about 29% of the world's seabirds with bellies containing plastic. It's pretty astronomical. In the next 11 years, we will make as much plastic as has been made since the industrial plastic production began in the 1950s, said Denise Hardesty, a senior research scientist and study co-author. Most of the plastic is in the form of small pieces, but Hardesty has also found larger items from model cars to cigarette lighters. The Center for Biological Diversity launched its own ocean plastics campaign in 2012, securing an EPA pledge to take steps to clean up ocean plastics. In August, we began a campaign to push Target stores to stop giving out 1 billion single-use bags that contribute to plastic pollution every year. And for more information, please go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. If you want to hear a rebroadcast of this show, please tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, tune to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 1:15 on Wednesdays, right after Democracy Now!, for a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update. Or you could go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous versions of the Earth First Update. Free Radio Santa Cruz is currently without a studio. Free Radio Santa Cruz needs a new studio as soon as possible so that this program and other free radio programs can be produced more easily and distributed around the world. We need a couple of hundred square feet of space, economically priced, with a bathroom, electricity, and 24-hour access. If you know of a possible studio location, please send an email to frsc at freakradio.org. That's frsc at freakradio.org. We are offering a $500 reward for information leading to a one-year lease on a new studio for Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz when we have one. I want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.